happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that's John Rauhaus playing in the background. The holidays are in full swing. I'm not ready. Are you ready? I am definitely not ready for this, but they are. And a quick reminder, the Fretboard Journal is a reader-supported magazine and a reader-supported endeavor, which means that everything that we do here, the magazine in its print and digital forms, the online content, the weekly videos that we produce and share with you all, and yes, all the podcasts we put out happen because enough readers around the world want to see this thing flourish. I would love it if you would join us if you haven't yet. You can go to fretboardjournal.com. You can get a digital subscription for 4 issues for just $30, no matter where you are in the world. Or, of course, you can get a 4, 8, or 12 issue subscription to the print magazine, which is the world's only keepsake coffee table guitar magazine. It's going to be filled with all sorts of interviews and articles and histories that you won't find anywhere else. And it looks like no other guitar magazine. If you want to join us finally and haven't yet, use the discount code podcast19. And for the next week, I will take an even bigger discount off of any subscriptions or gift subscriptions that you may want or back issues. And I can't thank you all enough for subscribing and supporting in advance because it is really, like I said, what powers all the cool stuff that we do. Speaking of cool stuff, today's guest is a singer-songwriter named Odessa. You may or may not have heard of her, but that's okay because you've definitely heard one of the songs that she released. Back in 2014, she put out a self-titled album, and on that album was a song called I Will Be There that ended up getting used in a Subaru commercial and being one of the most searched-for songs of the year. Odessa has had quite a ride from being a fiddle player playing alongside Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros and Gil Landry to putting out this record on a big label to figuring out what happens next, what happens when you have writer's block and folks are asking you for your next hit. It's quite a story. I can't thank Odessa enough for joining the podcast. I had not spoken to her ever before this podcast. I knew her music and loved it and can't recommend it enough, but it was great to talk to her and hear how she got to where she is, what she's up to, and where she's at with her career. I think you're going to enjoy this interview. Before we get to it, a couple of sponsors to our podcast. First up is Retrofret Vintage Guitars. Can't thank them enough for sponsoring our podcast. They have a beautiful new showroom in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood of New York. And of all the stores that we talk about, of all the cool vintage shops, and there are a lot of them now, I can't think of another store in the world that gets such an eclectic, interesting array of instruments as Retrofret. Right now, they have a 1946 Rickenbacker B6 lap steel. You've seen that lap steel before. It's the black one, the Bakelite, and then the beautiful silver aluminum on it. They also have a 1960 Tweed Fender Champ amp, totally original, down to the Oxford speaker, available right now. And then perhaps coolest of all, in a store full of cool instruments, they have a 1964 Dan Electro double neck 3923. This is the Dan Electro with two necks. It's got the short horn bass on one side and then the one pickup guitar on the other. How cool is that? It's pretty cool. Go to retrofret.com, see their entire array of things, dive into their descriptions. Every time I read a description from Retrofret, I learn something about instruments, and it just never gets old. Our other sponsor for this week's podcast is our friends over at Mono. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags, pedal boards, pedal board cases, you name it. Mono is up to all sorts of cool stuff. They've resurrected the Tysco brand and the Harmony brand. They're doing all sorts of amazing things. On a far lesser scale, but just as amazing to me, they underwrite all those cardboard mailers that the Fretboard Journal's print edition goes out in if you subscribe. So no matter how angry your mailman is, you will be protected by Mono and your magazine will show up intact. So thank you to Mono again, monocreators.com. Besides the Fretboard Journal podcast, which we've been doing now for 10 years, we have a couple of other podcasts you should check out. We've got Luthier on Luthier, hosted by Michael Bashkin. That's sort of our deep dive into the world of guitar making. I learned so much from that podcast. This month's guest is Sam Guidry, who you've probably seen alongside Brian Gallup and at guitar shows. He is making some truly, truly beautiful guitars. That's a good one. And then the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast that I co-host is about to celebrate its one-year anniversary. That's hosted by Skip Simmons, an amp tech I've known for 20-plus years in Northern California. The premise is basically car talk for guitarists. People call in or write in with their questions about amplification. Skip goes off. I have learned a ton from this podcast. We are up to 25 episodes. So many people have written in from around the world with their questions. It's truly become its own little community within a community. And if this podcast sounds dry to you, the idea of talking about tube amplifiers, rest assured it is not. Skip's giving parenting advice, life advice, cooking advice. He's a colorful character. I think you would enjoy it even if you could care less about amplifiers. I'll just say that. All right. Those are the only plugs I have for you guys right now. Go to our website, though. We have a ton of free, cool, new content, including a video and interview with Molly Tuttle and a lot more. And again, thanks to everybody for tuning in and subscribing. And I hope you enjoy our interview with Odessa. Odessa, thanks for talking to us on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I think, were you in, you may have been in a really early Fretboard Journal when you were in the band Barefoot, right?
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
I have a vague memory of that. Yes, long time ago.
And throughout your career, I mean, I remember you were playing fiddle back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you still are, but now you're playing guitar as well.
Yeah, I mean, I played a little guitar then, but I've been focusing more on guitar for the last 10 years.
Yeah, and I want to get to all that. But did you grow up in a, like, were you learning to be a classical violinist, or was old time music in your family, or how did the music thing start?
Well, my dad was a musician. He's not around anymore, but he was, when I was really little, he played guitar, and my parents decided to start me on violin lessons when I was 4. I think my cousin played or something, and I wanted to play because she was playing, and she ended up quitting, and I just kept going, and it was classical, and I had private lessons every week, and then I was in a couple of different orchestras, and I was really heavy in the classical world, like into my teens. And then, I'm not sure what happened, I just sort of lost interest in it because I had been doing it for so long. I was starting at 4 years old, and then you hit like 17. Like, I feel like I already had like a lifetime of that. And my dad really liked all kinds of music. I mean, he had great taste in music. We listened to like a lot of old classic rock and all kinds of stuff, but he was interested in like folk music and kind of old time, not really much bluegrass, more old time. And he would take me to this little fiddle competition. I remember when I was a kid, and he would always be like, we should learn fiddle tunes. And I was kind of not into it, but then I started warm up to it. And then I started to play with different bands around my hometown in Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. And all those were more, they weren't like old time or bluegrass or anything like that, but they were just more singer songwriter, like little rock bands. And then I started to get into the world of, you know, just accompanying and like improv and playing music on the violin other than classical. And then I got interested in fiddle because I went to this festival called Hardly Strictly in.
Sure.
Yeah. Have you been there?
Of course. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. So when I was probably 16, we went to that festival, my whole family, and I saw Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings play, and I was like, "What?" I was so blown away. Like, what is this kind of music? And then Old Pro played that year. I think I was 15, probably, yeah, 15. And I remember asking somebody at the festival, I was like, where are all these where do these people live that play this kind of music? Because I really didn't grow up listening to it, you know? And they were like, oh, Nashville. And then, so I moved to Nashville when I was 18 and started kind of taking fiddle lessons and learning that. So I'm not a real fiddle player because I didn't come from.
You started too late.
I started way too late. I can't like rip bluegrass or anything like that, but I do love old time fiddle and old time music. And I got into that for a while.
So what?
And then that led, you know, barefoot.
Yeah. What was it like moving straight from probably high school to Nashville? And I'm guessing you didn't know a ton of people.
I don't know anybody. I didn't know a single, I knew one person, but he wasn't even in town when I got there. So, yeah, that was really something. I bought a plane ticket out there and I stayed in a hostel for 2 weeks and I just sort of putzed around and like found a bike, I guess, just for something. And I literally on foot and by bike explored that entire city by myself and stayed in this little hostel. It was behind a hospital, Baptist Hospital. If you know Nashville, you know where that is. It's a really weird area. But there were all these people from Germany and Belgium, like staying in the hostel.
Sure.
And so I kind of ended up becoming friends with them and we would go around and see music. And one of the first, I walked from Baptist Hospital to Station Inn. I'm sure you're familiar
with
Station Inn.
Sure.
Yeah. I walked there one night because my friend he was a guitar player. Again, he wasn't in town when I was in town, but he gave me a few pointers. He's like, you definitely have to go to Station Inn.
Okay.
So I went there a few times and I saw this band called Old Black Kettle, and now these ladies are all friends of mine. It's like Sarah Siskin and this woman, Julie, and they played a show one night. It's just incredible. Their music is so beautiful. Julie Lee is her name. She's written for like Alison Krauss and just like gorgeous musicians. So I saw them one night, and I don't think I met them that night, but what ended up happening is after going around and just seeing all this music and getting really inspired, I was out at a bar one night with all of my foreign friends and we were watching the World Cup and I ran into somebody that I actually knew, another musician. He introduced me to this girl, Emily Warner, and her and I became just like fast friends and she knows everybody in the music scene in Nashville. And we just totally clicked as friends. So she bought a plane ticket back to California with me and we flew, we barely knew each other. We knew each other for like a week. And she flew to California with me, packed up all my stuff, and we road tripped back out to Nashville. And I got a house with her. She was looking for a place to live. She had just graduated, or she was in college, actually. She was going to Murfreesboro, I think.
That's amazing.
But I, it was amazing. I had been homeschooled. I have never been to a day of conventional school in my whole life. I took like a nude figure drawing class in high school, but that was it. And so leaving home was a huge deal. I'm very close with my family and they were all like, why, what are you doing? And why? I was like, I'm not sure yet, but I'm going to figure it out. And I remember leaving and my parents just standing on the stoop of our house, like bawling, like, don't leave. Cause we were such a like close family.
Sure.
So that was the hardest part, you know, but I just wanted to explore. And being in Nashville was such a culture shock in a really cool way, you know, like having grown up in Northern California and then people just live differently, not, you know, different parts of the country.
Was there a crazy learning curve in terms of trying to fit in as a fiddle player in Nashville with like established musicians, or how did that go?
Not really. I mean, it was really pretty smooth. I think from playing, I learned the Suzuki method way with classical music, which you learn a lot by ear. So I think that really kind of gave me a leg up because I learned pretty quickly, like fiddle tunes and how to like accompany people and everything. So I'd only been in Nashville for like a month when I got my first touring gig and I had just been out with some friends jamming music and this band was coming through town, and they heard me play and sing, and I got a phone call from them, and they were like, "Hey, our lead singer just quit, and we need somebody to fill in and replace her, basically. Like, are you interested?" But I had never, I knew like a few songs. I was not a singer. I did not consider myself a singer at all. So when they asked me to do that, I was like, yeah, sure. And I remember our first year, I was like terrified because I'd really never sung in public. But that was a learning curve, being on the road with that band and kind of basically faking my way into learning how to sing and sing in front of people and write songs.
But you did it.
I did it somehow. Because I spent tons of time like writing and sort of like learning how to write songs kind of on my own.
So that was always kind of simmering on the side?
Honestly, not really.
No.
Because my dad would always tell me, like, you need to learn. He would have me sing harmony with him and stuff because he had a little band with my mom. And he would always say, like, you really need to learn to write your own songs if you want to be a musician, like, and really have some longevity. It would be important. And I think you could do it, you know. That was always maybe just like the rebellious side of me was like, no, I don't need to do that. I'm shy and kind of more a behind the scenes person. So I always thought that. So I didn't really focus on that. When I got to Nashville, I did start to get really inspired because I was going out and seeing all these people and listening to these songs they'd written and then getting into musicians and artists that wrote all their own songs. And it was like this whole new world. And then I got really interested. And then I was like, okay, actually, I think I want to do this. But it was all pretty natural. And the learning curve was definitely just being on the road and performing and singing in front of people was the biggest thing.
Yeah. And I imagine being in Nashville, you're running into music heroes on a semi-regular basis just by being around.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, you could go like out at any given night of the week and see just the best of the best. And, you know, I guess, I don't know, maybe I was just so naive, or like I didn't have a lot of fear, or I just kind of just did whatever, like wasn't terribly self-conscious, but just about getting out there and like going out and playing places and, you know, it was a really neat time.
Yeah. So, I mean, I saw you, you were in the magazine. I think I may have saw you got maybe Barefoot played at a Merle Fest like a long time ago, like 12 or 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And then the next time I saw you, you had like a gold top Les Paul and were playing I Will Be There. When did the guitar come into the equation?
That particular one or just like the guitar?
Just any guitar. Were you playing all along?
I didn't own a guitar until I bought that Les Paul in like 2011, I guess that was.
Okay.
When I got that. No, 2012. But before that, I would be out on the road with the band, and of course we always had guitars around. So I would just pick up a guitar and like noodle and try and write songs. But I never made a decision to become a guitar player or practice the guitar or anything like that. Now I do. But I guess when I was on the road with Barefoot and those bands, I did play a few songs on acoustic guitar, and then I really started playing guitar more when I was living. I moved in with a boyfriend at the time in Nashville. I was like 22, mm-hmm. and my dad passed when I was 21, and I got his guitar, and that's when I started playing more, because it first of all it was just really special to play his guitar, and then that's when I started writing a whole lot more. And then I moved in with this boyfriend at the time, and he had a guitar there. And I was touring a lot, but then I'd have, like, you know, 3 weeks off. And that guitar, I remember, was missing two strings. So I basically wrote that first record, like, on a guitar missing two strings. But that, I kind of came up with different tunings and just sort of figured out my own way to play. Like, I've never had a lesson or anything, so I play pretty much all by ear. And half the time, I don't really know what I'm doing. still on guitar.
What kind of guitar was that, or is that?
It was like a net, like kind of a shitty, just, oops, I don't know, can I say that on this?
Yeah, sure.
It was just a acoustic guitar.
Okay.
It wasn't anything special. And then when I decided I wanted to get like a nice electric guitar, because I've been playing friends' guitars and stuff. This is like around 2012 time when I got that Les Paul. And I went to Groom's Guitars.
Sure.
And I had saved money that year to buy a car, because I've always had a really funny relationship with cars. Like I didn't own a car for years, and I rode a bicycle. And so I really wanted to buy a car finally. I was like, I'm going to do it. I've been on the road with Edward Sharp. I saved up some money. And then I remember just being like, actually, I kind of want a guitar. Like, maybe I can buy a guitar. So I went to Groom's and I found this guitar. It was literally all the money I had saved. And I bought the guitar and I remained carless for like 2 years. But I bought that Les Paul, and then that guitar really made me fall in love with guitar playing, because it's so much fun to play. It sounds like so beautiful. You can just play one chord and some notes. So after I got that guitar, I really started getting into playing and playing a lot and practicing and figuring out, you know, just becoming more comfortable on that instrument so I could play my own songs and sing them.
Did you have an amp?
In public. Yeah, I bought an amp.
Okay.
I bought an amp. Now I have this little Princeton Fender Reverb amp that I love, little 70s amp. But at the time, I just bought like a twin reverb or something from a pawn shop in Nashville and had that for a while.
Nice.
Yeah.
And then, so that first album had I Will Be There, which kind of blew up, right? It was a huge song.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it had a little moment. It was really cool.
You know, you're in Nashville. There's a million people in Nashville trying to work on their singer-songwriter album or whatever you want to. Like, did you know right away that this was... Did this thing get shopped around and were labels courting you? Like, how did this all evolve?
No, not at all. I mean, again, like, I really didn't have aspirations to be like a big solo artist or something. I really, because I was on the road a ton playing as a side musician. I was pretty happy doing that. But I just started writing, and like, I never felt like pressure. I mean, I was inspired by people around me that were writing, but I guess after a while I did start to like the dream inside me started to form of like, oh, I want to make my own record, and I want to actually maybe have music that's totally all my own that I create. But that process took like years to kind of come to fruition. And even it took me a long time to write, you know, a handful of songs that I thought were good enough to be a record. And once I did that, I had like, you know, I don't know how many songs, but like enough to make a record. And there was a guy in town named Jakir King, the producer in Nashville. And I'd heard a lot of good things about him. And I also made a little EP with a friend of mine, Ian Fitchick, and Aaron Emery, and my friend Bo Stapleton helped me make this little EP. And that was before I made my record. And that was kind of like just an introduction into like recording my own music. But we shopped that around a little bit, but I was on the road with Edward Sharp. And I wasn't really focusing on my own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But after we made that EP and some time went by and I wrote some more songs, I was like, actually, I really want to make a record. And then the desire was like burning inside me. Like, okay, now I really want to make my own record. And I quit Barefoot. They weren't super happy about that. I'm like, I'll go make my own record.
Okay.
And I blindly emailed Jakir, because I got his email from my friend who had worked with him. And I sent him I sent him Hummed Low, which was just pretty much totally done. It's almost as it is on the record. I'd done it in GarageBand at my house. And I sent him that song and a couple other songs. I just said, hey, I live in Nashville and just heard you're a great guy and really love what you've done. And here's something that I've recorded and I really want to make a record with you if you're interested. But I didn't have any management or like any name of any kind except for, you know, being a violin player. And then Jakir emailed me back like 2 days later. And I just thought he's probably not going to ever get back to me, but what the heck, you know?
Sure.
And then we had coffee. And then he told me what he cost. And like, he's like, you have a manager, a lawyer. I'm like, whoa, 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 no, all of that. And then it took us about 6 months to figure out how to actually make a record together, because I really didn't have resources or any kind of, you know, no management, no label, nothing, really just me and the songs. And Jakir took a huge leap of faith and we made the record together. And I actually had an offer, I think, from ATO because they had heard some of the demo stuff, but I didn't feel comfortable signing a record deal before I had made like a record. I didn't really want the label's influence. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make it on my own and then go from there. And Jakir was willing to kind of weather it, that process with me. And then we figured out how to make it. Just him and I and Brad, the engineer. And then kind of failed the first attempt, like went into the studio with a couple of really great players. But I kind of bombed because I'd never really been in that kind of studio setting before. And it was at House of Blues and it was sort of, I was too fancy and I didn't like that there was a time limit and all these things. So we were in there for a couple of days and I was frozen. I could, like, performing the songs live was weird. Everything felt off. And Jakir was like, you kind of seem miserable. Like, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I guess just call this off. Like, I don't think I can do it this way. He was like, well, what if we just set up a little studio on Brad's house, like in his living room, and you kind of just recorded at your own pace and we brought people in. I was like, that sounds amazing. So we did that. And the record, it took like about a year to make, because I would go on the road and because I needed to still make money and be out like doing, you know, making music. And I would go on the road as a side musician and come back and work on the record.
Sure.
And yeah. And then I met Edward Sharp during that time too. So I was out on the road with them a lot. And then when I would be in Nashville, I would just call up Brad and be like, hey, can we record this week? And then call people in and have musicians come in. And that was very organic and like very laid back process.
And then you make a record, and then what happens?
And then I made that record, and then I was on, I'm sure you're familiar with Raylan Baxter, he's a good friend
of
mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Raylan and I did this hilarious tour together. We drove across the country in his Dodge Dart, uninsured, like 1969 little car with our friend.
Okay.
And made this little, Raylan had an idea for his own. It was his tour and I was playing violin. But the first night of the tour, he was like, hey, do you want to play a few songs during my set? And I was like, sure. So I played some of my new songs. It was really cool. And I got to experience, like, I think that was probably the first tour I played my own music on. But anyway, we drove across the country. We got to California. And when we were in L.A., I had a friend who worked at Red Light. And it happened to be, like, walking distance from where Raylan and I were staying. And I actually, this is way before the record, but this will tie in. So I went to Red Light to meet with my friend, and I had like a demo CD of songs that I'd made on my computer or at home, you know. And I went to my friend at Red Light, and I played it for her. She was the manager there. And while I was playing it for her, this woman, Maria, walked by the room, just poked her head in. She was a licensing agent. She had a little company in that building.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, oh, I like your music. She said, do you have a sync team? Or, you know, I didn't even know what any of that meant. I was like, no, just have this CD. And she was like, well, here's my email. If you ever record a record, let me know, because I really like your music. I was like, cool, thanks. So fast forward a couple years, make the record with Jakir. And then I emailed her. I said, Maria, I have a record. And then I gave her all the songs and she just worked some magic. Several of the songs, even before that Subaru commercial, she got commercial, or not commercials, but, you know, just TV show placements and different things. And she would just email, I didn't even have a lawyer, but she would email me and say, hey, what do you think of this fee? And I was like, that looks great. And she's like, well, you know, it's for the show. I'm like, cool. And I never watched any of the shows. Like, but the Subaru commercial, I remember she called me. She's like, this is a good commercial. And it's a great, you know, it's a great primetime spot. And then I emailed him. You know, of course, I had to run all the placements by him. And he was like, wow, this is amazing. Yeah, let's do it. And after I got that sync, that commercial aired, and I had been playing more of my music around Nashville, and I had been really sort of attempting to, like, move more and into, you know, getting my name established as a solo artist. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't have management still. I was just kind of doing it on my own. It was just me and Jakir and Maria, really. And then, the day after that commercial came out, I had started working with a manager. So it was all kind of happening. The day after that commercial came out, like, it just got a lot of attention, tons of streams and a lot of attention. It was like the highest Shazam song of that year. Like, a lot of momentum happened around it. And then all of a sudden, my manager was like, wow, you have calls from all these labels. I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
So it was totally out of the blue. And I really did not know anything about the industry in that way. You know, I didn't know who half the labels were. I mean, so it took off a little from there. And then eventually we decided, after talking to a bunch of labels, decided to go with Republic. I just liked them, like, personally most out of the bunch. And then, then I signed the deal with them.
Yeah.
And they put out the record.
When a song like that, you know, as an outsider, I don't know, like, does having a song in, like, a really prominent commercial translate? Do enough people do the legwork of, like, Googling to find out who that artist is and then maybe buying your record or streaming your record? Like, does it pay off beyond that initial commercial fee that you get?
You mean into the future?
Yeah,
life of the song?
Yeah, like, do you end up getting, you know, way more fans than you would have had you not been in the commercial? Or do a lot of people just
hear
it? Yeah, okay.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know if people, yeah, I mean, I know that people kind of think of that as selling out or whatever.
No, I was just curious.
Incredible. Yeah, no, it's an incredible vehicle. Like, what other way would you, you know, would something be placed in front of so many people? And for whatever, like, people really, it touched people's hearts. And I think they were just like, well, I've never heard that. And then I really didn't have any presence almost at all online. So it was just people streaming, just people listening to the song. Like, I didn't have an Instagram account, I don't think, like, nothing. So it was really just the Spotify streams and the Shazam and all that. And I think it really did help people to, you know, turn people towards my music and then towards the record. And that song has definitely had a good life, and totally attribute it to that.
Is there a great story behind that song?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, definitely written from the heart in my apartment one day. It actually, you know what it was? It was that Wurlitzer part. Mm-hmm. Was my, that little dun 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 dun, dun was just something I'd come up with, and it was my ringtone for like 6 months, that line.
Okay.
On my phone. Because I really liked that, and I would just sit there and play it all the time. And yeah, I really honestly don't really remember writing that song. I kind of remember just sitting at the Wurlitzer and coming up with the melody, and then it was inspired by a certain person who will remain anonymous, and yeah, just kind of like came out one night, and I just wrote it, and then I kind of forgot about it. And when I brought it to Jakir, he was like, wow, it's a really great song. We should definitely record that. So I didn't really, I didn't think like, oh, this is amazing. I just wrote it as like any other song
Yeah.
that I would write, you know, about like a personal experience or something that somebody or something that moved me.
Yeah.
But even when we recorded, I didn't think it was special. I like the song. Like, I like all the songs, or that I believe in all the songs on the record, but I didn't think it was particularly grand in any way.
Sure.
So you know?
Yeah. And you find yourself on a big label, and how does that all go?
It went okay. I mean, it wasn't like a terrible experience or anything. It was always a little strange because I think looking back, when the label, after the record came out and the label put me on the road, I was on the road for a better part of a year, opening solo for a lot of people and some trio shows. But that was a very difficult year for me because that was really my first time like touring my own music. I've been touring for seven years constantly, but totally different scene when you're a side musician or you're in a band with five people that are all in the band together.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a little bit of a tough year because I just would find myself on the road, like up in front of people every single night by myself playing, and it was just very new, the whole thing. And then, you know, that Instagram became really important, and like your social media presence and all that was really new to me. And I'm an extremely private person, and it just felt kind of overwhelming, the amount that they, or what they expected of me. You know, it was just sort of like charge out of the gates, like, here I am, you know. And I was just still figuring out who I am musically. And so that year of touring and playing all those shows kind of left me a little exhausted. And then when I got off the road, the single, well, in the middle of that year, after, I guess it was 2015 when the record came out, in 2016, you know, major labels do this where they try and push a single off your record or a couple, and they see if they blow up at radio, you know. And if they do, they put a ton of money behind you. But if they don't, then they sort of forget about you. And it's not an uncommon story. I know a lot of artists have experienced this. And I think the label, like, I really love Avery, who's the president of the label, and his brother, and they really believed in my music and the song and everything. But in the end, they did their whole testing at AAA radio, or how, I don't even know really how it works, but I Will Be There and the other single didn't blow up like they thought it would.
Okay.
So after that happened, they really just, like, their support kind of went bye-bye. And I was like, whoa, okay, we're, you know, because they've been putting money behind my tours and, you know, pumping you up and being like, you're going to be huge and everybody's excited. And then the day after I got that news from my manager, like, I really felt the support withdrawn and the excitement was gone. They were like, what, we're not going to make millions of dollars. Now we're not super interested until, you know, and that was hard. And I don't take it personally. I think, you know, it's what they do. They're a big major label, and that's their game. So all that was really, like, personally very difficult to deal with and to feel, like, stay inspired. And then that created discord between me and my manager, and, you know, and then money started getting tight, and it was like, whoa, okay, what is happening now? Because it was, you know, riding on a high horse, and then just sort of feeling like the foundation fall out from underneath you.
Yeah.
And yeah, super intense. And I had moved out to LA, and so I was living back here nearer to my family, which is really nice. And so in a lot of ways, I mean, the label, like, signing with them, you know, you get a big advance check, and that's wonderful. And that allowed me to move back out to LA and go on all those tours. And but then when it didn't go like they planned, that was a little bit of a dark time. So I was like, I started getting a lot of pressure from my manager and the label, like, hey, you need to write, like, you need to get into the writing room with people and try writing like a hit of some kind to pull yourself out of this.
Okay.
That's kind of a strange thing to ask of an artist, somebody who's just been on the road all year, you know, singing, like playing from my heart, and then to have it, it really felt like everything just kind of crumbled. It was like, whoa, did I just fail miserably?
Yeah.
You know, but to flip the coin of that, and I really don't regret it, because they, just being on that label, I did get a lot of exposure. You know, I didn't blow up like they planned, or maybe like people expected, but through them, I think I, you know, just through like publicity and everything, I think a lot more people heard my music. Yeah, it was kind of a wild ride, and I don't know if I'll sign with another major label again.
Well, this wasn't that long ago, and it's crazy to think that like radio plays still played a factor in your future, because that's kind of in the past.
I know.
And your song was played on a Subaru commercial and was heard by millions of people. You know, weren't you on the Ellen Show?
Queen Latifah. She personally called, and that was her mom and their favorite song. She called my manager. Her manager called and was like, we want her on that show. It's the sweetest thing. I love her.
All right.
Yeah. I thought, you know, I still really don't understand exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Very strange. It's politics. It's like,
sure,
yeah,
you gotta deliver results.
Harsh.
Yeah,
gotta deliver those results. No.
So what, how did you get out of this funk and create All Things? Like, tell me about it.
Well, I moved back to Nashville for 6 months. I moved back into my old apartment that I had rented there, where I had written my first record.
It was still available?
Yeah, weirdly, one of my best friends, Gil Landry, him and I lived across the hall from each other.
Okay.
In super cute old building that was like falling apart, but just had a lot of character. And it was on Belmont. And weirdly, kind of about the time that I just thought, I need to get out of LA for a little bit. I'll go to Nashville and see if I can like conjure up the old magic in my old apartment. So it happened to be available for rent. Gil was like, you know, the other side's available. Or no, he had moved out of his side. He was in. He was like, do you want to take my apartment over? I was like, yes. So moved there, got out of LA, kind of got away from everything. I was like, this is going to be great. I'm going to write a record. And I did not write anything. It was very depressing. It was middle of winter. And I was back in my old apartment. It was just not a productive time. I bought a piano to put in the apartment. Like, I kind of set everything up like I should write, but then it just, I don't know, you can't really force when you can't force things, I've learned. So I was still doing some touring at that time, but I went on a safari. I went to Africa with my aunt and uncle. Like, I just sort of traveled and was on tour. And I came back to L.A. I'm still living in that little apartment, but I came back to L.A. to play a show at the Wiltern opening for, who was I opening for? My friend Lone Bello. Mm-hmm. And I remember flying back into L.A. and meeting up with my friends who are in my band here and playing that show. And I was like, all right, it's time to move back to L.A. Like, what am I doing in my old apartment in Nashville? So I gave up that apartment, gave the piano away, moved back here. And that was in the summertime, and that was just I had a couple of just personal things that happened in life that were really difficult also during that time. And just besides the label stuff, and it was a difficult period. Money got really, really tight, and I just sort of, I don't know how I started writing. I didn't decide that I was going to start writing this record, but a friend of mine, my friend Tay, and his girlfriend lived in this house on Tipton Terrace with another of our friends, this beautiful place in Eagle Rock, LA. Mm-hmm. And they were leaving for the summer, and Chase said, hey, do you want to sublet our room? I said, sure. And I'd actually lived, that house has kind of been in the friend group for a while. And when I was touring with Edward Sharpe, my friend Mark lived there. This is like, you know, years before that. And I had stayed in that house before, so it was kind of familiar. It's a beautiful place. Like, out of every window, there's just this gorgeous view of little valley, and it, you know, the birds fly by the windows. It just feels like you're sort of removed from the city, even though you're still very near LA. But so I took over their room in the house, and I decided to just kind of stop touring for a little bit. I told my manager basically, like, do not contact me for a while. Like, you have to leave me alone. I need to regroup here. Because he was like, you need to start writing. Like, you need to, you know, like, the label's expecting all these things. And I was like, okay, everybody, please just leave me alone. And I'm going to go be a hermit for a while.
Sure.
So, again, not really with the, I don't know what I was doing. I just needed a break. So when I was at the house, it was just me and another friend living there. And without going into detail, I did experience some like really heavy personal stuff. So I took the time off and was up at this house. And I remember one day just going into a room at the back of the house that actually has a disco ball, which is one of the songs on the record is about that.
Yeah.
And I just sat back there and, like, I wrote that song, All Things, like, in, like, 5 minutes. I just wrote the whole song. I was like, wow, I think I just wrote a song, you know? And I sent it to my friend. He was like, that's very cool. I like it. And I didn't even write it with any instruments. I just wrote the instrumental part. And it was sort of about what I had been going through, you know? And then from there, it was like, yeah, it just sort of kept happening. And then the desire to like really play music and write came back. And I just started writing, not really writing songs, but writing like just free writing in my journal and poetry and things like that. And I was writing a lot and got my guitar out and was just playing a lot. And yeah, wrote pretty much that whole record, except for a couple songs that I had written previously. Or like a year, you know, a couple years before that made it on the record. But yeah, over the next couple of months, I didn't hang out with a lot of people. I mean, I just kind of holed up at the house, went to the Wii Spa every so often, like, relax.
Nice.
And then would go back up on my little perch and like keep writing. And during that time, I met Jonathan Wilson, who I met him through a friend. A friend asked me to play some strings on his record. And Jonathan and I kind of started just hanging out as pals. And we were jamming a lot, just like, you know, we'd stay up and just pick up some instruments and start playing. And he was really inspirational during that time, too. So it kind of just like reignited the fire of creation. I was like, oh, wow. Okay, something's happening. This is cool. And then I just sort of rode the wave and wrote all those songs. And that's how, I think it was, yeah, over like probably 3 months.
Nice.
And then, yeah. And then I had all the songs, and then I asked Jonathan if he wanted to produce it, and all that happened pretty fast. He's like, sure, yeah, I love the songs. Let's do it.
What are the jams with Jonathan Wilson? What do those sound like? Was it actually working on these songs, or were you just like playing whatever?
No. I just play whatever. Like his house, he doesn't live there anymore, but it's the studio that he used to have. And there's a big, beautiful grand piano and like a stand up bass in the corner and, you know, an electric guitar plugged in at all times, a drum set. So,
nice.
You know, I'd sit down on the piano and he'd grab the stand up bass, like, it was just kind of sporadic little jams, but it's amazing how you can just playing music with another person can give you, and especially somebody like him who's incredibly musical and just inspired, can inspire you. And he was really encouraging, just like, you know, keep at it, like keep writing and all is not lost, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, so they were just kind of just in the spur of the moment musical jams, but we didn't write anything together or anything like that.
Yeah. And you finish this record, and I know it got produced a few different places, yeah. But what happens next? What happens with the label?
Oh, so I told the label and my manager at the time, was like, hey, she's making a record with Jonathan Wolfson. They were like, cool, because they respect him. And I made it. I told them I made it on my own dime. They didn't put any money towards it. And I was like, I want to make this, so in case you don't pick it up, it's mine. They were totally cool with that. And because I wasn't sure, you know, like I didn't know if it would be something, because they look for something pretty specific. And after I got into the studio, we started working, I sent them some material. I think it was the beginning of the next year. We had recorded the bulk of the record. And I sent it to Ben, my guy there, and he was like, yeah, we think it's amazing, but it's not really our thing. And then we just parted ways. It was really easy, very amicable, just like, okay, cool. Well, that was fun.
Easy breakup.
Easy breakup. I mean, and it was really sweet. I remember, like, emailed Avery. I was like, thank you guys so much for taking, you know, I mean, it was just very friendly.
Yeah.
Nothing crazy. It was, you know, it was sad, and I didn't really know what the hell I was going to do, because I was, again, kind of broke.
Yeah.
Whoa, I just spent all of my money on this record, and the label does not want it. And what do I do next, you know? But the process of parting ways with them was pretty painless.
And then what do you do next? How do you put out your own record these days?
Well, you hire a publicist, and you just do it. You just decide you're going to put it out, and then you go for it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm learning as I go. But I have gotten a lot of advice from people. I just pick people's brain all the time, like my friends who are managers, my friends who have self-released, like, and I asked so many people, and I waited for a label. I mean, I was open to a label picking this record up, but nobody bit. A lot of people were like, wow, it's beautiful, but it's too pretty for us, or it's, I don't know, you know, like people just thought it was amazing, but not for us.
Yeah.
So after like a lot of those conversations, I was like, well, I mean, I'm not going to just not put it, like hide it forever. And plenty of people do it on their own. So I have a friend here, Laurel Stearns, who my friend Ryan introduced me to. And she told me, you know, she was like, really who you need, you just need a good publicist, you know? And so a couple months ago, like over this past summer, I sent it around to a bunch of publicity agencies, and a couple people got back to me, and I had a meeting with Force Field PR. Mm-hmm. And I loved their energy, and they were super excited. All right, let's do it. And they were like, okay, let's set a date. And then we set the date. And which singles do you want? And how do you want to go about doing it? You know, so it's just been kind of trial and error for me, learning how to do it. And yeah, really, it was just a decision to go for it, and pretty easy. I mean, difficult in that, like, the label took care of so many things for me last time, and yeah, it's been a lot, but extremely rewarding just doing it myself this time, because everything that happens, I'm like, wow, I had a cute thing. I mean, I did that. You know, and the PR company, I mean, they've been amazing. And with social media and all these things, like, it's, you're sort of directly, you have a direct connection to your audience now, you know? So if you don't have a label, it's not the end of the world, although it's nice to have that backing too.
Sure.
But, yeah.
Well, it's a fantastic record. Are you playing out much for it? Did you do an album release party already?
I played a little album release party night before last.
All right.
Or album release.
Yeah.
It was so sweet. It was at Club TG in Atwater Village, and my two friends, Todd and Greg, which is a trio, and my friend Sophie Winterson sang with me. And they were out of town. The only time they had to practice was that day. So we got together in the morning, like, practiced all day for the show and played the show. And a lot of friends came out, and it was really, felt so good to finally get it out into the world. And I don't, you know, I don't really know how it will be received or where and when. It's like,
you're just waiting.
Just waiting, like, okay, here it is, everyone. Hope you like it.
Are you going to tour, or are you going to stay closer to home?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to next year, for sure. I'm not going to probably play any more shows this year. I just want to go home and spend time with the fam for the holidays. And then next year, I really want to play. Yeah, I definitely want to play some shows. I don't imagine. I'm probably not going to hit the road too hard, but I would love to get around to, like, all my favorite places and do some tours with friends, and all that's in the works and will definitely be happening.
Cool. Well, let me know if you come to Seattle. We'll get you over here.
Absolutely will. Love Seattle.
Is the gold top still the main guitar?
Oh, yeah. That thing is so freaking heavy is the only thing. So I've tried to. It's like 12 pounds. I think I have permanent back problems.
What year is it?
So now I sit down. It's an 83 re-edition.
Okay.
So it.
Extra heavy.
Those guitars, it's extra heavy. I mean, but I try to play other guitars, but I just can't. I just like that guitar best. So yes,
that's hilarious.
Still with me.
It's awesome.
Yeah, totally. Ball and chain.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Well, Odessa, thank you so much. This was...
Thank you so
this
much.
This is quite a journey you're on. Are you staying put in Los Angeles for a while? In terms of home?
Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
Done with the Nashville the Nashville apartment?
Oh my God, yeah. I think that chapter is permanently closed.
Good. Hopefully someone moved in so you're not even tempted.
I know. I hope. Yeah. So... thank you so much.
No, I love the album. It's very raw, and obviously, like, you know, you're not hiding behind anything. I think is it on Hard As They Try, you can, like, hear someone coughing in the room. I loved it.
Yeah, that's my friend Laura Campman. She's amazing.
I love that you just kept it in there.
It's a voice memo.
Oh, wait, that's all
like,
it
I
is?
Yeah, on my phone.
See? All you kids listening to this, you can record a whole album on your voice memo.
Exactly. You just have to be in the moment, you know?
Awesome. Thanks again. This was fun.
Of course. Thank you.